21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
Everybody needs a helping hand. Take a look at your fellow man and tell me what can I do today. Because everybody needs a helping out. If that ain't what it's all about, tell me what... What can I do? What can I do today?
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer, and Noah Dankner runs our board. Rick Lamplew joins us this hour to share some of his observations, concerns, and discoveries while working as a volunteer in Yellowstone National Park. As a naturalist, Rick's love of wolves and help to protect them has called him back to the park after having been a volunteer as a younger man. Now, he and his wife Mary take part of each year to give guided tours, drive buses, shovel snow, and anything else the park requires during the winter months when only a few areas remain open to the public, and one of them is the one they help serve. His book, In the Temple of Wolves, A Winter's Immersion in Wild Yellowstone, is a beautiful personal memoir of his encounters and experiences while observing the wolves of Lamar Valley Buffalo Ranch on the northeastern corner of Yellowstone's National Park. His writing is frank and descriptive, asking questions about life and death, human impact on wildlife, the choices we make, and the reality that we must stop killing wolves. Among other stories, he reminds us that some of the last remaining bison of North America are in captivity at Yellowstone. The wolves he shares with us hold a distinct place in the ecosystem, whom without even the course of rivers change. Thanks so much for joining us, Rick.
Oh, you're quite welcome, and it's very nice to be here, Zoe.
Well, your book is really beautiful. I enjoyed every bit of it. And why wolves? What has attracted you to wolves, particularly in our country?
Well, that's a good question and a very good starting point. When my wife Mary and I first volunteered at the Lamar Buffalo Ranch in the winter of 2012, I didn't go there because of wolves. I went there because that was a part of Yellowstone that Mary and I had backpacked in for about 10 years prior to that. We love that area of the country. It's wide open. You can see for miles, lots of wildlife. I went there because I wanted to be able to wake up and go to sleep in that valley. And the only way you can do that is by working there. So during that first winter, we, as you described in your intro, we drove a 14-passenger bus filled with people and a guide who went out in search of wildlife, and mostly that was wolves. And so just about every day, I was exposed to wolves. We had great encounters, great views. And so I stood in awe of these animals living in this really frigid conditions. I mean, we had over a minus 40 day one morning, and yet these animals are able to survive, bring down elk that weigh five times as much as they do. They're able to make it through the winter. And so I just started gaining a respect for the wolves, but it wasn't until I started writing about them that I saw the other side, which was wolf hatred and people who really don't want these wolves in our country or any country at all.
And I have to say, you know, I've done a number of shows because this is a deep and abiding interest of mine of protecting endangered species. And to think that the wildlife that once was really the sort of epicenter of so many ecosystems is the very endangered wildlife worldwide is an extraordinary reality we need to be honest about. And you've done a beautiful job, and I hope you don't mind if I ask you to start at the end of your book, where you actually talk about the history of the decimation of wolves, using Japan as one example and our own country due to sort of the immersion of cattle ranching and what that did to our Western territories in particular, but not just in the West.
Yeah, and now would you like me to talk about Japan or the American West?
you can use either one. I thought Japan was just a beautiful, quick example, which you can do in a few sentences, and then we'll focus in on what has happened here in America and why the campaigns in Wyoming and Idaho, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, I think that Japan really crystallizes the whole human drive to annihilate wolves, steal their territory, and create wolf haters. Wolves in Japan, I used a book called The Lost Wolves of Japan by an author, Brett Walker, and wolves in Japan were revered. People actually left gifts at wolf dens, and within a short period of time, less than one human's lifespan, it went from a revered animal to a despised animal. And the reason was the Japanese government wanted to bring in what was called modern agriculture, modern ranching, and that meant ranching as it's done in America. And so they brought in an American rancher, Dunn was his name, and you know, he knew about poisons, he knew about bounties, he knew how to get rid of wolves. And within a very short period of time, wolves were gone from Japan, and of course, still are. So that, what that did for me as I read that story, in addition to making me very sad, was I realized that if a government can turn an entire country against wolves, can't a government protect wolves? Mm-hmm. Can't a government encourage its citizens to protect wolves? That's why I think the Endangered Species Act is so vitally important.
Yeah, even though it's often breached. You know, as you say this, I think of this woman I'm reading about now in Africa who's working with the Maasai warriors who, for their naming, have always gone out and killed lions. Well, the lions are going extinct, and in her effort now, she's actually training these same young Maasai warriors to be lion guardians. So the question she asked was the same one you did. If the government and the culture has propagandized us to hate a certain animal that we even name a predator, though they're not really predators. They eat to live. They don't predate for sport like humans do. Could we change that? So one of the things you do a beautiful job of talking about something we've touched on in the past, which is when these animals are hunted, and hunted unnecessarily because the wolves can exist side by side in the same way bear, from our other guests have showed us, can exist side by side with cattle ranchers. There is something that happens in the ecosystem, and in particular with the decimation of wolves, we have this rise of the coyotes. Talk to us a bit about this. It's really a challenge.
Yeah, it's when American settlers came to the New World, coyotes, if you would look at a map of what would be the United States, coyotes occupied about the middle third of that map. Within 100 years, 200 years of arrival, wolves were pretty much eradicated in the United States everywhere but Minnesota. That left coyotes to expand their range wherever they wanted, and of course they did. Coyotes are incredibly intelligent animals. I'm, in terms of full disclosure, I'm on an advisory board for an organization called Coyote Watch Canada, so I also advocate for coyotes and really appreciate them. And they're incredibly intelligent, and they knew that following humans, wherever humans went, there was going to be food, and there were not going to be wolves. And so we now have coyotes everywhere you can look. But the problem now with this coyote issue is when people think of coyotes, they're thinking of coyotes that have adapted to living with humans.
Mm-hmm.
We, on the other hand, out here in Yellowstone, for example, yesterday, my wife Mary and I watched for 40 minutes a coyote pack of six animals feed on a bison carcass in a river. And it was a beautiful thing to see. We were, you know, far enough away, we were behind a tree, we didn't change their behavior in any way. But I appreciated that's the way coyotes really live.
And it's so interesting in terms of the way in which, as a naturalist, you're able to paint the picture for somebody who might not have the same kind of intimacy, all the way from talking about the ravens and the magpies who come to feed and how the coyotes actually look for the ravens because the ravens find the dead animals. And then you describe these incredible scenes of how the coyotes or the wolves will stand down an elk over long, long periods of time so that there's this kind of ongoing symbiosis that animals know among each other, but we humans are constantly interfering with. So for example, you tell this one story of a calf that is obviously dying, and my inclination, like many people's, would be, oh my God, can I go save the calf? Talk to us about this. You know, even sometimes our best intentions aren't the best things to do.
Yeah. Well, that the chapter title is How Death Feeds Life. And for me, that was the first time that I had really understood how death feeds life. You know, Mary, as I said, and I have backpacked in Yellowstone. You know, I've been chased by an elk. I've had to get out of the way of bison. I've been around wildlife, but I had never really seen this event of this calf was not yet dead. A coyote came up, found the calf, and decided, gosh, there's no wolves around. This is going to be a great meal. Started prodding at it. The calf tried to lift its head. It lifted its head, looked at the coyote. The coyote just jumped back a little bit and then came back at it. And I decided at that moment that even though this was going to be hard to watch, that I would spend the rest of the day, off and on as my work schedule allowed, coming out to a spotting scope with my digital voice recorder and standing there and observing and recording what I saw. And, of course, those notes became that chapter.
When I was reading, and of course it's not easy for me, I'm a real animal sensitive, and but it brought me to an appreciation for what all the animal activists I've interviewed over the last 15 years have been talking about in terms of these ecosystems that are being destroyed from the top down by humans who are only selfishly looking out for very short-term gain, but not based in fact. And by that I mean, let's look for a moment again, if you don't mind, at the extinction of wolves. I'm going to go back and forth between these animals, if you don't mind, because I think it gives us this bigger picture that your book does for the reader. In Montana, Idaho, I mean, Montana, I did a little research on just to see how many cattle they actually have, and it's a couple million, and they have about a couple thousand deaths a year, as you portrait. I'm looking for my notes on it. And yet they go after killing wolves as though the wolves are killing everything. And they're not.
Correct.
So yes. If you can share with us a little bit. Oh, here it is. In Montana in 2010, there were 22,000 head of cattle who were lost due to non-predatory causes. And most of them are killed by dogs or disease or something else. And there were 1,000 predatory deaths out of, this was, I looked up, 2.6 million beef cattle and 18,000 dairy cows. So we're talking about a very small percentage of cattle that were actually lost to predation, which could have been dogs, and the rest were lost to disease or starvation or whatever, or injury. Talk to us, though, about the propaganda campaigns going on in the Northwest.
Well, yeah, it's a very serious issue. You know, I actually live year-round in Oregon, and, of course, we have 64 wolves there now, and just north of us is Washington with 52 wolves. Both of those, the animals are located in the northeast parts of those states. Those states are also, those areas are also heavily filled with cattle and sheep. And so the Cattlemen's Association and the Sheep Herders Associations are literally in Washington. They are running a campaign right now, an anti-wolf organization is running a campaign to put up billboards that basically say to Washingtonians that your children are going to be the next thing on these wolves' menu, that wolves are going to eat your kids. Defenders of Wildlife has started a campaign. They just put up 9 billboards around the Spokane area that counter this and basically show that you have more likelihood of dying on a national basis from a lightning strike than you do from a wolf attack. So it's what these are, really orchestrated campaigns by these organizations, but the picture gets even worse, actually, because of the midterm elections. This year coming up and next year could be some of the worst ever for conservation issues and for the Endangered Species Act. There are big factions that would like to gut the the Endangered Species Act, not just for wolves, for the whole act. So you've got local organizations, you've got national organizations, and you've got state and federal government all essentially working in tandem to make life awfully hard for wolves and other endangered animals.
And yet this extraordinary research that's been done on what happens when you change the relationship between this hierarchy of animals, of coyote, wolves, elk, bear, etc. And there's one theory that I'd like to discuss when we come back from our first break, which really talks about this. And there's this beautiful film about it, even how wolves change rivers. Our guest is Rick Lamplew. His book, In the Temple of Wolves, A Winter's Immersion in Wildstone. I'm sorry, in Wild Yellowstone. And you can find a link directly on the front of 2121stcenturyradio.com or go to www.ricklampluh.blogspot.com.
This is Eva Sargent from Defenders of Wildlife in the Southwest. If you want to help the Mexican gray wolf, go to our website, defenders.org, hit the Take Action tab on the first page, and sign up for our alerts. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zahara Hieronymus.
Halfway up Ranger Hill, just above the Lamar Buffalo Ranch, Mary sat on the edge of a lichen-dotted rock outcrop, feet dangling, blonde hair blowing in the breeze. While she searched with binoculars, I set up a spotting scope near her and scanned. A moment later, Mary whispered with reverence, "Got it. Wolves on a kill. Lots of ravens. Right below that lone conifer across the valley." I followed her directions and zoomed in on 06 as the Lamar Canyon Pack's alpha female pulled a strip of meat from a carcass that was halfway submerged in Rose Creek. A raven perched on the antlers. I counted 12 points and thought, that must be the big guy from yesterday. The one that we had watched for 11 hours as he stood off 06 and her pack.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. The music behind Rick Lamplew's reading of his own book is by Susanna Doyle. It's a beautiful book. Again, I'm not going to say it because we're going to ask this question of if you know the name of the book of our guest, Rick Lamplew, you will, by his great courtesy, win a copy. You can call us at 410-922-6680. That's 1-800-WCBM-680. If you know the name of our guest's book, you will win a copy of it. And of course, I'll be repeating it after they call in. So, Rick, I want to come back to, before the break, you were describing this wholesale campaign going on out in the Northwest to kill wolves. And with this campaign telling families that your children will be killed next. And the truth is, wolves seldom will come close to humans. Now, there are coyotes in our cities, and they're not afraid of humans and are kind of in a symbiotic relationship with humans and other wildlife. And there may be issues that come from their being acculturated, but a wild wolf is seldom going to have reason or proximity to kill a human, and yet that's what they're promoting. So what's the fear if less than 1% of all livestock is injured or killed by wolves? Is there this wholesale effort to actually, you know, decimate the population, destroy it so that there are none left on Earth?
Yeah. You know, Zoe, that is such an important question, and it's one that I struggle with. I really think that wolf survival in this country and in every country that I have read about is a cultural issue rather than a biological issue. In other words, wolves left to their own, they'll breed, they'll reproduce, they will hunt, and they will expand their territory, and they will monitor and control their own numbers. That's, you know, a scientific fact. But the human intervention, there is a strong wolf hatred, a strong hatred against this predator is not reflected in our feelings about cougars, which also kill livestock, or about bears, which, of course, also kill livestock. There's something really different about wolves, and it goes back hundreds of years. Barry Lopez talked about it in his book of Wolves and Men. John T. Coleman talked about it in his book called Vicious. The history going back, you know, in my book, I just started from the Middle Ages and went forward. And, you know, by the end of 1700s, wolves were almost completely eradicated from Europe. But yet, 100 years later, the book, or the Grimm's Fairy Tales, came out in England. There had not been a wolf in England in 300 years, but a book came out and produced Little Red Riding Hood. So, you know, as humans, we can do something that animals can't do. We can teach our next generation to have values and to remember things that animals can't do. And that's where the literature comes in, and I think it is so terribly important. If that's what helped to create this wolf hatred, that literature has to help change that into something that more approximate respect for wolves.
And you know, I'm working on a book about all of these extraordinary animals planet-wide called Spirit Animals, and there's like white bears and white buffalo and white wolves, and a distinct representative of each of these cultures and communities. And the mythologies that are associated with these animals tell us the story of cultural's past history. And yet, every time I look at the indigenous people's relationship to all the wildlife, it is with such distinct reverence, respect, acknowledgement of their powers, a gracious reverence for what they teach us, a desire to learn from them, a desire to preserve them. And so we stand in this contrast between those of us who naturally, for whatever reasons, possess values and attachments or reverences that are very much like all indigenous peoples worldwide. And then there's another part of our culture that has this avarice for destruction and for killing and for bloodlust and the canned camps where they actually put bears or lions or wolves or other animals captured in a captive area that then people come and pay a fee to come and kill with bows and arrows or guns and bullets. And this sickness is a kind of impotency. I mean, you're a man. Describe to me when you talk to, now you work with photographers who come to the park, and they also have a curiosity that could be called voyeurism, but at least it's better than a desire to kill. But I don't know, I'm a little conflicted about all of these humans now coming into wilderness, presumed wilderness, and I don't know if it stays wild when photographers and hunters come in.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I'd like to clarify is that Yellowstone National Park is not a wilderness. You know, by definition, no motorized vehicles would be allowed in a wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Yellowstone National Park is just that. It's a park.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple years ago in the winter, we were sitting around the bunkhouse, which is where people congregate in the evening, and one of our guests for the evening was a park ranger, a young man, maybe mid-30s. And he turned to the guide who was sitting next to me and asked, in all seriousness, do you think Yellowstone's wolves are wild?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question.
Yeah, and at first I laughed. I thought, well, how silly is that, you know, coming from a park ranger? But it's a question that really stuck with me as I watched wolves. Now, here's where this becomes really critically important. You can hunt outside of Yellowstone National Park. And for many hunters, what that equates to is driving a pickup truck somewhere where they know wolves are going to be, getting out of that pickup truck, pointing a long cylindrical object at that animal, and firing. Now, if that wolf came from Yellowstone National Park, it's seen people do that every day.
Mm-hmm.
Trucks, cars pull over to the side of the road, people get out, point a long cylindrical object at them, and nothing happens to the wolves. So, you know, those wolves in Yellowstone and in Glacier would be another area, would be the same, are under, need special protection because of that. That one wolf that I talked about in the reading that you played, and thank you for playing that reading.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. Yeah, it's lovely.
06, was killed in a legal wolf hunt 16 miles outside of Yellowstone National Park. Nobody knows why she went there.
This was the alpha female who had an important pack.
Oh, yeah, the Lamar Canyon pack. This wolf was internationally known. I mean, her death was covered by international media, a wolf. So, you know, there's a tremendous respect for these animals. And in reality, the people who hate wolves are a much smaller number than the people who want them to exist. But the people who hate wolves are very vocal and in positions of power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really different.
And yet, as you point out so beautifully in your book, as have others working with the white bears of British Columbia or the lions of Timbavati, Africa, that there's more made in the economy by inviting peaceful photographers and wildlife viewers than they make from issuing licenses for killing wildlife of any sort. And in some places, that's really now working to the advantage of preservation. Talk to us a bit about this reality that we have the facts, and you certainly, with your history in business, know that numbers matter to politicians.
Yeah. Before I volunteered for 3 winters at the Lamar Buffalo Ranch, I wasn't always a $12 a day volunteer. I have an MBA, so I understand statistics. I understand how to look for challenges and opportunities in data, and that's what I did in one of the chapters called The Cash Cascade. And really, I was upon using the words trophic cascade, which we'll probably talk about tonight. But the cash cascade is really important. It just depends on who's counting the cash. The towns around Yellowstone National Park have all benefited a great deal. There was a study done by Montana State University that showed that people who come to Yellowstone, particularly to look for wolves, drop $35 million a year in that three-state area, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. So that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Getting that down even smaller, there's a little town just on the northeast entrance of Yellowstone called Silvergate. And in that town is a photographer who has a studio. He's been there more than 20 years. When he first set up his studio, the summer was his time of business. Winter was a dead time. Now, more than 20 years later, after the wolves have been reintroduced, winter is his best season.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whether you look at it from a big scale, $35 million, or one particular photographer making a living for his family in a town that maybe has 16 year-round residents, wolves and the people that they bring are a valuable commodity.
And it's so interesting because then it remains to the hunters and their alliances with, I guess, the gun lobby and the politicians who are the ones driving this, let's kill everything. Let's kill everything we can kill because that's what we like to do. And it's not even necessarily out of need for food or for eating. It's just sport. And the tragedy is that there's still humans who find this so appealing in their own person. And yet that's changing, fortunately, because culture's changing, but not fast enough.
Yeah. And let me go back to Oregon for just a moment.
Please.
The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is funded primarily by hunting and fishing licenses and other associated fees. People who are engaged in those activities have decreased in number. That means the funding to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the people responsible for enforcing Oregon's endangered species law, our state law, they don't have the money to do what's needed to be done. And as in any business, if your main customers that you depend on for income are saying, you know, I really think you ought to reconsider that decision. I think you ought to tell us exactly where these GPS coordinates on your wolves' collars, you should tell us exactly where those wolves are located. That's actually a proposal being made right now in
Oregon.
That's
extraordinary.
It is extraordinary because right now in Oregon, what the state Department of Fish and Wildlife provides is essentially a polygon. It'll show an area where these GPS coordinates. So, you know, that area may be maybe a mile around, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a rancher and you've got cattle in that area, you now know. Now it's your responsibility to go out there and be there, be the human presence. do the things that you can do to keep wolves from your livestock. Why would you want the exact coordinates? The only reason I can come up with is you want to shoot that animal.
Mm-hmm. And yet there is a program going on, the Wood River Wolf Project in Idaho.
Yes.
Which is trying to make a difference and showing, as did our guest who ranched and had livestock with bear when he was doing that work, that as you say, it's just a question of awareness and then putting up the fences and being vigilant and not killing off that which is so important to our ecosystem. I mean, we talked with the Natural Resources Defense Council, I believe it was, at one point about, and the Defenders of Wildlife, about the lobby that liked to kill elk because it's a bigger animal. So they got rid of the wolves so that there'd be more elk, and then the coyote replicated more, and now there's this total imbalance in the ecosystem. And so you mentioned something called the trophic cascade, which they had brought up. Talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, this is a fascinating theory. Two of the biggest promoters of this theory in the United States and perhaps the world are from Oregon State University, the university that's within walking distance of my house, where I got my MBA. So I'm a little biased with this university. But their names are Bill Ripple and Bob Bestia. Bill Ripple decided to study the aspen trees in Yellowstone. And what he found was this. This is really fascinating. He went in. So the last wolf was killed in Yellowstone in 1926. And then they were reintroduced in 1995. That's about a 70-year span where there were no wolves. And what Bill Ripple and this trophic cascade and Bob Bestia, what they're saying basically is, in that 70 years, elk got really lazy. They could eat wherever and whatever they wanted. And so the willows that grow on the riverbank, for example, or the aspen that grow a little further up the hill, were being just chewed away. So when Bill came in to look at the aspen forest, he found trees that were more than 70 years old. So those trees were young when there were still wolves. He found trees that had grown since 1995 when the wolves came back. They found very few aspen trees in the middle of that. In other words, if the wolves had not come back, there would not have been replacement trees mm-hmm. for these 70-year-old aspen. They're going to die, and there would be no trees to replace them. So aspen would disappear from many parts of Yellowstone. In the 4 years now that Mary and I have been out in the Lamar Valley, we've actually seen the increase in the willows in particular because they're very red against the white snow. They really stand out. And we were in an aspen stand the other day where the young aspen were 10 feet. So they're now out of elk danger. And it was just beautiful to see. Now, I have to say that I've discussed this theory with guides and scientists who have come to the ranch. And some of them roll their eyes at it. And they say it's much too simple of a theory for something as complex as an environment. Some people say it's climate change. Some people say it's fire. I really believe the trophic cascade theory, but it is that. It's a theory, and we're only talking about 20 years' worth of data. And, you know, in reality, that's an eye blink.
Mm-hmm. But it is interesting, and we've certainly found that with other loss of wilderness areas and what happens to, you know, the ecosystem and the chain of life that's in it, whether it's a destruction of the conifers in one of the rainforest or some other understory that the deer eat, because, you know, it's also interrelated. And I think that's the bottom line. And when people think that you can just take apart the environment piece by piece, like we have the human body in medicine, we end up with exactly what we see in medicine. Which is, we don't treat the whole person or their wellness. We treat it bit by bit, disease by disease. You know, so we'll take out your heart and then we'll put in a new one. And then, you know, then we'll cut off a leg and you'll get another. And it's the same thing. It's the same attitude that everything is, what's the right word? A commodity. whether it's a wolf or a tree or a human. And it's a true tragedy of our loss of a feeling state. We'll be right back. Our guest is Rick Lamplew, and his book, In the Temple of Wolves, A Winter's Immersion in Wild Yellowstone. It's a Create Space independent publishing platform, a 2013 release. You can find him at www.ricklamplugh.blogspot.com.
Hi, this is Rick Houston from Primitive Cafe. You can find us on Facebook, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
In the middle of the night, I slip from the warm log cabin into the below-zero temperature outside. I pull the door closed, hoping not to wake my wife, Mary. Still, the click of the latch resounds in the silence of the wild. I crunch onto the ice and snow-covered path, excited to be alone with the night. Frigid air freezes my nose hairs and burns my lungs. A full, yellow-orange moon, dark craters obvious, turns scattered clouds tangerine. Though I wear a headlamp, I leave the light off. I don't want my vision trapped in a narrow, bouncing cone. Instead, my eyes adjust to reflected moonlight as I meander toward the bunkhouse, scanning for bison. A herd surrounded our cabin yesterday, swinging their massive heads side to side, bulldozing through the snow, hungry for dried grasses that provide the nutrition of an empty cereal box.
You're listening to a reading by our guest, Rick Lamplew. His book, In the Temple of Wolves, A Winter's Immersion in Wild Yellowstone, a 2013 release. And it's a beautiful book. I encourage all of you to get it if you're not the one who won In the Temple of Wolves. It's not a long book. It's beautifully written. It's very engaging. And you'll learn a lot, as I did. I have to thank you as a naturalist. And that clip on the bison that we just shared, you've done a beautiful job also, if you don't mind taking a moment and summarizing for us also the history of the bison in our nation and as now seen in Yellowstone, because I thought you've just done a magnificent job of paying honor to their survival.
Yeah, these bison, I would honestly have to say, are one of my favorite animals. And working at the Lamar Buffalo Ranch, I really did get exposed to their history. We would explain the history to all the visitors to the ranch. And in the late early 1900s, there were fewer than 24 wild bison left in Yellowstone National Park. Now, to give you a perspective, there are more than 4,000 in the park today. So early 1900s, 24 bison left. The federal government allocated what was then a small amount of money to reinvigorate the herd, brought in some genetically pure wolves, bison from Texas, and a couple genetically pure bulls, and put up a enclosure in Mammoth, Hot Springs, in the north entrance of the park, and started breeding bison. That was the first reintroduction of its kind, and highly successful, and so much so that they had to move that whole project out to the Lamar Buffalo Ranch, and that's how the place got its name.
Mm-hmm.
They built pens out there, the fences all the way down to the Lamar River, and eventually the herd got so big that, ironically, the Park Service started killing the bison and giving them to Native Americans, and then realized that, you know, we just need to let these bison go and let them breed with the few remaining wild bison, and the herd was reinvigorated and literally saved.
Mm-hmm. And yet still it's such an issue because there still is hunting and poaching, and we're covering this on other shows. But it's such an extraordinary picture when you say that, because by the time, as you point out, European settlers came to the New World, there were 30 to 100 million bison on this continent, and we were down to a couple dozen. or six. I mean, and we see this, though, with the wolves and the coyotes. Wolves used to be in every part of the world, and that's not true anymore. I mean, they didn't exactly thrive in certain areas, but you could find them on every continent, put it that way. And as you point out, you know, it's so easy to kill off animals within a very short period of time. So when you look at this history, then Yellowstone is really sort of like a petri dish to me, a microscopic view of a colossally global issue, which is the killing off of animals that are so important to the hierarchy of the ecosystem. So give us the big picture, if you would, of the war on wolves as a specific example, where we are, where we stand, where we have to go.
We are at an incredible crossroads right now. I just published a report called The State of the Wolves, and it's a look back at 2014 and a look at 2015. And I contacted other wolf advocates in both state and regional wolf advocates. I got information from regional and national conservation agencies. And frankly, though, as I read all of this and tried to put it together, it scares me. I'm not a conflict-oriented person. I don't necessarily like conflict. I don't even like reading about conflict. But I really believe 2015 and 2016 are going to be incredibly intense years in terms of wolf advocacy and the protection of these essential animals. I talked a little bit earlier in the show about, there's organized campaigns to get rid of wolves, both from organizations and at the state and regional and federal government levels. All of that's going to come to fruition over the next 2 years.
But as you and others that I interview keep pointing out, that, you know, ranchers do graze their cattle and sheep in wolf country because wolf country is generally in the same areas that these expansive lands are. And so we encroach on their territory, and then we manage also to reduce the animals that they would have fed on anyway. And then we seek out to kill them. But as you point out, there's if we kill off the natural prey base, then what do they have to eat but livestock? And you say, you know, there is some consumer action people can take on our end, which isn't even wolf advocacy. But you said we can address this issue by either stopping eating beef and sheep or buying predator-friendly meats that have been raised without predators being harmed. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this there's a brand, Predator Friendly is the actual brand. You can find it on the web at predatorfriendly.org, and there are other brands as well, but that's the largest and the oldest. And these are ranches, like there's a ranch right near where we're living right now that is certified Predator Friendly. And that means that these ranchers have made a commitment and they are audited. They don't just say it. They are actually audited by an organization that comes in to make sure that they are using non-lethal deterrents, meaning they keep wolves and livestock separate without killing the wolves, and that when those deterrents stop working correctly, those managers of the ranches have to be fast on their feet and adapt and come up with something that does work. So what this predator-friendly brand does is it puts the rancher in control of their future and maybe taps into a market that they didn't have before. But the thing that I like about it so much is it really, they're making a commitment to say, when something stops working, I'm going to figure out something else. These are not lazy ranchers. These are people that are really committed to not just their ranch and their profits, but to the environment that sustain those animals and their living. One of the things that Mary and I sometimes do when we go out to restaurants, when we ate beef, we would ask if this was predator-friendly beef. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that not one restaurant did we get any light of recognition. So the brand has a long way to go in terms of, you know, people realizing how important this is, but it can happen.
Well, it's another example of how consumers at the grassroots level can start to shape some of the choices, like our efforts in another area altogether of labeling GMOs. I mean, the assault on the environment and on wildlife is the same assault that's going on humans. It's just taking different forms, whether it's war known as war or war known as agriculture. One of the things you talk about in your book is a man named Rick McIntyre, who you call the Archbishop of Wolves. And I thought it important just to mention him because he's had a good deal to do with shaping so many visitors' perspective of wolves. And he's written so many thousands of pages, which are transcribed notes. Talk to us a bit about Rick.
Well, he is an icon in the Lamar Valley and in Yellowstone. People know the car that he drives, and when they see it, they pull over because if Rick's there, then there's some kind of wolf activity going on. He's either trying to find their signals with his little H-shaped radio antenna, or he's got a spotting scope out, and he's watching them. The beauty of what Rick McIntyre does, and he works 7 days a week. He doesn't get paid all those 7 days, but he is there every day of the week, even on his days off. And the beauty of what he does, not just in terms of the scientific information he helps collect, you know, Yellowstone's wolves are probably the most studied wolves in the world, but he is a true ambassador for these animals and for this park. You know, he will stop what he's doing, not always, the man is busy, but he will stop what he's doing and give an impromptu, what I call a sermon in the book, but you know, these are lectures, and he will explain the who bred whom. Mm-hmm. Of the wolf pack that we're watching, and he'll tell the stories of how the Molly's pack came to have its name and the war that preceded that, with the wolf war that preceded that. And this is a very smart man. And part of what he's doing and part of what other wolf advocates, I don't call Rick a wolf advocate, he really is a scientist, but part of what wolf advocacy does is to give these animals a name and a face, because then people care about them even more. So 06, the wolf that we talked about earlier, the famous alpha female, her actual number was 832F. Well, who are you going to care more about? A wolf called 06 because that's the year she showed up and took control of the pack, or 832F? And there's other names like that that, you know, wolf watchers in particular give the animals. All of that's so important for these wolves' future.
You've done a really beautiful job, and I want to thank you for taking time to share some of it with us. You know, one of the things you wrote about that I thought was fascinating is that wolves, you said, will watch an elk herd and pick out the weak one and go after it, and its members will abandon it. But it's not true of bison. Bison will encircle and protect the weaker young ones and even surround a fallen bison to keep it from being scavenged.
Yeah. And we actually saw that. Saw that actually happen. There's only one pack in Yellowstone that makes its living with bison. That's the Molly's pack. And they live all winter in Pelican Valley, where it's very deep snow. All the elk leave, but the bison stay. So those wolves had to learn and had to evolve to learn how to kill bison. They're a little bigger mm-hmm. than the wolves, say, in the Lamar Valley, because they need to be bigger. And they came to the Lamar Valley one time, and generally when they came to the Lamar Valley, some other wolves were going to die. There were going to be fights, and they were going to take down some elk because that was easy prey for them. But we saw them actually go into a bison herd, pull down one of the bison, and try to kill it, and the other bison came back and drove them away and encircled that wounded bison. So, you know, we've actually seen that happen. Now, they eventually did get that bison, but the bison did try to protect their fallen member, mm-hmm. whereas with elk, it's every animal for himself. In fact, you know, wolves will go into an elk herd and get it running and do what's called sort and sift, and they'll pick out the elk that they're going to get, and once they pull that elk down, the rest of the herd stops.
Stays right there. Yeah,
they can be eating 100 yards away.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
There's no danger now.
Well, and as you showed, though, wolves will kill coyotes who try to scavenge their food, but then they won't eat the coyote because they're full. There's so much in your book. It's a beautiful treatment. Folks, buy In the Temple of Wolves, A Winter's Immersion in Wildstone by our guest, Rick Lamplew. Go to ricklamplew.blogspot.com or 21st21stcenturyradio.com.
Stay connected with stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Lucero.